Chapter 10. Dembowska Cartel, 21-2-01. Despite her role in its foundation, Kitsune had never visited Tsarina Cluster. Like Wellspring, Kitsune had held great power in CK's pioneer days. Unlike him, she had not released it gracefully. While Wellspring had retreated from day-to-day government and pursued his strategy of rule by fashion, Kitsune had blatantly challenged the Queen's advisors. In the years while Lindsay recuperated, she had had some success. She announced plans to move to CK, but as years passed, she refused to disturb her routines, and her power decayed. It had led to a break, and the destinies of CK and Dembowska had radically diverged. Disquieting stories of her transformations had reached Lindsay and CK. Rumor said she had embraced new technologies, exploiting the laxity that had come with detente. Dembowska was still a member of the Mechanist Union of Cartels, but was constantly on the verge of expulsion, tolerated only as a clearinghouse for Ring Council defectors. Even the Ring Council was appalled by Dembowska's emergent technology of flesh. In the hands of the Zen Serotonists, the Ring Council struggled for stability. As a result, it was falling behind. The cutting edge of genetics technology had been seized by the wild-eyed black surgeons of the Cometaries and the Uranian Rings, mushrooming post-human clades like the Metropolarity, the Bloodbathers, and the Endosymbiotics. They had discarded humanity like a caul. Disintegrating micro-factions surrounded the Schismatrix like a haze of superheated plasma. The march of science had become a headlong stampede. The Mechanists and Shapers had become like two opposing armies, whose rank and file, scattering into swamps and thickets, ignore the orders of their aging generals. The emergent philosophies of the age, post-humanism, Zen Serotonin, galacticism, were like signal bonfires lit to attract stragglers, deserters' philosophies. Lindsay's fire burned brightly, and its glow attracted many. They called Lindsay's group the Lifesiders Clique. Tsarina Cluster's cliques had the power of minor factions in their own right. The cliques formed a shadow government in CK, a moral parallel to the distracted formal rule of the Queen's advisors. Clique elites moved behind the scenes, imitating their paragon Wellspring in deliberate webs of self-spun obfuscation. The forms of power and its realities had been gently disentangled. The social arbiters of the polycarbon clique, the Lifesiders, or the green Camarilla could work wonders with a dropped hint or a lifted eyebrow. It followed, then, that groups considering defection to CK consulted the Cicada cliques before formally requesting asylum. Normally, this was Wellspring's domain. In the latest case, however, Wellspring was absent on one of his many recruiting trips. Lindsay, knowing the nature of the case, had agreed to meet the representative of the breakaway group on neutral ground in Dembowska. His entourage consisted of his chief lieutenant, Gomez, three of his postdoctoral students, and a diplomatic observer from the Queen's advisors. Dembowska had changed. When they debarked into customs amid the sparse crowd from the liner, Lindsay was struck by the warmth. The air was at blood heat and smelled faintly of Kitsune's skin. The smell brought seeping memory with it. Lindsay's smile was melancholy. The memories were 85 years old, as thin as paper. They seemed to have happened to someone else. Lindsay's Lifesiders checked their luggage. Two of the graduate students, mechanist types, murmured their impressions into their lip mics. Other passengers waited at the scanning booths. Two Dembowska agents approached their group. Lindsay stepped forward in the faint gravity. "Harem police?" he said. "Wall children," said the first of the pair, a male. He wore a thin, sleeveless kimono. His bare arms were covered with authority tattoos. His face seemed familiar. Lindsay recognized the genetics of Michael Carnassus. He turned to the other woman and saw Kitsune, younger, her hair shorn, her dark arms stenciled in white ink. "I'm Colonel Martin Dembowska, and this is my wall sister, Captain Murasaki Dembowska."
"I'm Chancellor Lindsay.
These are clique members Abelard Gomez, Jane Murray, Glenn Sillard, Colin Sillard, Emma Meyer,
and Undersecretary Fidel Nakamura, our diplomatic observer. The cicadas bowed, each in turn.
I hope you weren't distressed by the bacterial change aboard ship, Murasaki said.
She had Kitsune's voice. A minor inconvenience.
We are forced to take great care with the Wall Mother's skin bacteria, the colonel explained. There is a considerable acreage involved, I'm sure you understand.
Could you offer us exact figures? Asked one of the Szilard brothers, with a mechanist's dry craving for hard data. Reports in Tsarina Cluster are clouded.
At last report, the Wall Mother massed 400,812 tons.
The colonel was proud.
Have you anything to declare? No? Then follow me.
They followed the Dombowskin into a confidential clearance office, where they left their luggage and were provided with sterilized guests' kimonos. They floated barefoot into the hot air of Dombowska's first mall. The cavernous, duty-free shopping area was paved, walled, and ceilinged in flesh. The cicadas padded along reluctantly, their toes just brushing the resilient skin. They looked with hidden longing at the shops, safe islands of stone and metal. Lindsay had schooled them to be tactful and was proud of their masked reactions. Even Lindsay felt a qualm when they entered the first long tunnel. Its round, gullet-like design tapped a deep well of unease. The party boarded an openwork sled, propelled by peristaltic twitches from the sinewed tracks beneath it. The slick wall was studded periodically by sphinctered plugs for pre-digested pap. Light glowed gently from translucent bladders swollen with white phosphorescence. Gomez, at Lindsay's elbow, studied the architecture with a trance-like intensity. His attention was sharpened to a cutting edge by a drug known in cicada circles as green rapture.
"They've gone for broke," Gomez said softly. "Could there be personality behind this? It must take half a ton of back brain to manage all this meat."
His eyes narrowed.
"Imagine how it must feel."
The Carnassus clone, in the sled's first compartment, touched the controls. A seam parted wetly in the floor, pitching the sled into vertical freefall. They catapulted down a multi-track elevator shaft, broken periodically by dizzying vistas of plazas and suburbs. Shops and offices flashed past, embedded in billows of dark satiny skin. The heat and smell of perfumed flesh were everywhere. Intimacy on an industrial scale. The crowds were sparse. Many were young children, running naked. The sled braked to a halt. The group disembarked onto a furred landing. Gomez nudged Lindsay as the empty sled slid back up the rails.
"The walls have ears, Chancellor."
They did, and eyes as well. There was something in the air on this level. The perfume was particularly heady. Gomez grew heavy-lidded suddenly, and the Szilard brothers, who had donned headband cameras, took them off to dab at sweat. Jane Murray and Emma Meyer, puzzled by something they couldn't define, looked about suspiciously. As the two Dombowskins led them off the landing and into the fleshy depths, Lindsay placed it suddenly. Sex pheromones. The architecture was aroused. The group followed a low-grav footpath, toughened skin marked with the massive whorls of endless fingerprints. The ceiling overhead was a waving carpet of lustrous black hair for traveling hand over hand. This level was clearly a showpiece. The former buildings had been stripped down to mere frameworks, trellises for flesh. Voluptuous organics rose at every side. Euclidean corners scrapped for smooth maternal curves. Structures flowed up from the floor to merge in swan's neck arches into the lustrous ceiling. Buildings were dimpled, hollowed, the sleek pink of sphinctered doors sliding imperceptibly into skin lightly stippled with down. They stopped on a furred lawn of an elaborate, massive edifice, its dark walls gleaming with ivory mosaic.
"Your hostel," the colonel announced.
The building's double doors yawned open on muscular, jaw-like hinges. Jane Murray hesitated as the others entered. She took Lindsay's arm.
"That ivory in the walls, its teeth."
She had gone pale under the cool blues and aquamarines of her cicada face paint.
Female pheromones in the air, Lindsay said. They're making you uneasy. It's back brain response, doctor.
Jealous of the walls, the post-anthropologist smiled. This place feels like a gigantic discreet.
Despite her bravado, Lindsay saw her fright. She would have preferred even the most notorious of cicada discreets, with their clandestine games, to this dubious lodging. They stepped inside. Murasaki addressed the group.
You'll be sharing the hostel with two groups of commercial agents from Diotima and Themis, but you'll have a wing of your own. This way, please.
They followed her along a walkway of flat ivory implants. One of Dembowska's myriad of hearts, an industrial-scale blood-pumping station, thudded behind the ribs of the ceiling. Its double beat set the rhythm to light musical warbling from a wall-set larynx. Their quarters were a biomechanical mix. Market monitors glowed in the walls, tracing the rise and fall of prominent mechanist stocks. The furniture was a series of tasteful lumps and hammocks, curved beds of flesh, dressed modestly in iris-printed bedclothes. The extensive suite was divided by tattooed membranous screens. The colonel tapped one membrane divider. It wrinkled into the ceiling like an eyelid. He gestured politely at one of the beds. These furnishings are exemplars of our wall mother's erototechnology. They exist for your comfort and pleasure. I must inform you, though, that our wall mother reserves the right to fecundity. Emma Meyer, who had settled cautiously onto one of the beds, stood up.
I beg your pardon.
The colonel frowned. Male ejaculations become the property of the recipient. This is an ancient feminine principle.
Oh, I see.
Murasaki pursed her lips.
You consider this odd, doctor?
Not at all, Meyer said winningly.
It makes perfect sense.
The Dembowskan girl pressed on.
Any children sired by the men of your group will be full citizens. All wall children are equally beloved. I happen to be a perfect clone, but I've won my post by merit, in the mother's love. Isn't that so, Martin?
The colonel had a firmer grasp of diplomatic niceties. He nodded shortly. The water of the baths is sterile and contains a minimum of dissolved organics. It may be drunk freely. The plumbing is genito-urinary technology, but it is not waste fluid. Gomez oozed charm.
As a biological designer, I'm delighted by your ingenious architecture, not merely by its technical adroitness, but by its fine aesthetics.
He hesitated.
Is there time for a bath before the luggage arrives?
The cicadas needed baths. The bacterial changeover had not quite settled in, and the blood heat of the Dembowskan air made them itch. Lindsay withdrew to one end of the suite and lowered the membrane wall. At once his tempo changed. Without his young followers, he moved at his own pace. He didn't need a bath. His aged skin could no longer support a large population of bacteria. He sat on the edge of the bed. He was tired. Without volition, his eyes glazed over. A long moment passed in which he was simply empty, thinking nothing at all. At last, blinking, he came back to himself. He reached reflexively into his jacket pocket and produced an enameled inhaler. Two long whiffs of green rapture brought interest back into the world. He looked slowly about him and was surprised to see a blue kimono against the wall. Murasaki was wearing it. Her body was camouflaged almost perfectly against the background of skin.
Captain Murasaki, he said. I didn't notice you. Forgive me.
She'd
been standing there in polite silence. She was flustered by his reputation.
I was ordered to...
She gestured at the door, a pucker in the wall.
You want to take me somewhere? He said.
My companions can manage without me. I'm at your disposal.
He followed the girl into the ivory and fur of the hall. In the lobby, she stopped and ran her hand along the smooth flesh of the wall. A hole sphinctered open beside her feet, and the two of them dropped gently down one floor. Below the hostel was a maintenance area. He heard a steady rushing of arteries and an occasional bowel-like gurgle from the naked walls. Biomonitors flickered, set in puckered rims of flesh.
"This is a health center," Murasaki explained. "The Wall Mother's health, I mean. She has a mind link here. She can speak to you here through me. You mustn't be alarmed."
She turned her back to him and lifted the dark fringe of hair at her neck, showing him the stippled interlink at the base of her skull. Green rapture washed gently over Lindsay, a tingling wave of curiosity. Green rapture was the ultimate anti-boredom drug, the biochemical basis of wonder boiled down to its complex essence. With enough green rapture, a man could find a wealth of interest in the lines of his own hands. Lindsay smiled with unfeigned delight.
"Marvelous," he said.
Murasaki hesitated and looked at him quizzically.
"You mustn't mind if I stare," Lindsay said. "You remind me so of your mother."
"You're really him, Chancellor? Abelard Lindsay, who was my mother's lover?"
"Kitsune and I have always been friends."
"Am I much like she was?"
"Clones are their own people," he spoke soothingly. "In the Ring Council, I had a family once. My congenetics, my children, were clones, and I loved them."
"You mustn't think I'm a mere piece of the wall," Murasaki said. "The wall cells are chromosomally depauperate, chimeric blastomas. The wall is not as fully human as Kitsune's original flesh, or mine."
She looked searchingly into his eyes.
"You don't mind talking to me first? I'm not boring you?"
"Impossible," Lindsay said.
"We wall children have had trouble before. Some foreigners treat us like monsters."
She sighed, relaxing.
"The truth is, we're really rather dull."
He was sympathetic.
"You find it so?"
"It's not like Tsarina Cluster. Things are exciting there, aren't they? Always something happening. Pirates, post-humanists, defectors, investors. I see tapes from there sometimes. I'd love to have clothes like that."
Lindsay smiled.
"Clothes look better at a distance, my dear. Cicada dress for social status. It can take hours."
"You're only prejudiced, Chancellor Lindsay. You invented social stripping."
Lindsay winced. Was he always to be dogged by this cliché?
"I saw it in a play," the girl confessed. "Goldreich Intersolar came through on tour. They showed Fernand Vetterling's Pity for the Vermin. The hero strips at the climax."
Lindsay felt chagrin. Vetterling's plays had lost all punch since he had become a Zen serotonist. Lindsay would have told the girl as much, but he felt too much shadowy guilt at the tragic course of Vetterling's career. Because of politics, Vetterling had spent years as a non-person. Lindsay could not blame the dramatists for choosing peace at any price.
"Stripping's bad form these days," he said. "It's lost all meaning. People do it just to punctuate a conversation."
"I thought it was marvelous, though nudity doesn't mean much in Dimbauska. I shouldn't tell you about plays. Didn't you start Kabuki Intrasolar?"
"That was Fyodor Ryumin," Lindsay said.
"Who's he?"
"A brilliant playwright. He died some years ago."
"Was he very old?"
"Extremely. More so even than me."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
He had embarrassed her.
"I'll be going now. You and the Wall Mother must have a lot to discuss."
She pressed her hand against the wall behind her, then turned to him again.
"Thank you for indulging me. It was a very great privilege."
A fleshy tentacle extruded from the wall behind her. The splayed clump at the tentacle's end grasped the back of her neck. She lifted her hair aside and adjusted the plug. Her face went slack. Her knees buckled and she fell slowly in the feeble gravity. Kitsune came online and caught her before she hit the floor. The body trembled briefly in a palsy of feedback. Then Kitsune stretched it and ran her hands along the arms. The face set itself. The body was all grace, electric with an old and ferocious vitality. Only the eyes were dead.
"Hello, Kitsune."
"Do you like this body, darling?"
She stretched luxuriously.
Nothing brings memory back like being in a young woman. What do you call yourself these days?
Abelard Lindsay, Chancellor of Tsarina Cluster Cosmosity Megasystems, Jovian Systems Division.
And Arbiter of the Lifesiders Clique?
Lindsay smiled. Positions in social clubs have no legal validity, Kitsune.
It's a position strong enough to bring a defector here, all the way from Skimmer's Union. She says her name is Vera Constantine, and that name means enough to you to bring you here?
Lindsay shrugged. You see me, Kitsune.
The daughter of your old enemy, and the congenetic of a long-dead woman whose name escapes me?
Vera Kelland.
How well you remember it. Better than you remember our own relationship?
We've had more than one, Kitsune. I remember our youth in the Zaibatsu, though not as well as I would like. And I remember my 30 years here in Dimbowska, when I held you at arm's length because your form repulsed me, and I missed my wife.
You could not have resisted me in any form if I had pressed. In those years I only teased you.
I've changed since then. These days I'm pressed by other things.
But now I have a better form, like the old one.
She shrugged the girl's body out of its kimono.
Shall we have a go, for old time's sake?
Lindsay approached the body and ran his wrinkled hand lingeringly along the long flank.
It's very beautiful, he said. It's yours, she said. Enjoy yourself.
Lindsay sighed. He ran his fingers over the splayed tentacular clump at the back of the girl's neck.
In my duel with Constantine, I had something like this installed. The wires lose a lot in translation. You can't feel it like this, Kitsune. Not like you did then.
Then?
She laughed aloud. The mouth opened, but the face scarcely moved.
I left those limits behind so long ago that I've forgotten them.
It's all right, Kitsune. I can't feel it in the same way anymore either. He stepped back and sat on the floor. If it's any consolation, I still feel something for you, despite all times and changes. I don't have a name for it, but then what we had between us never had a name.
She picked up the sleeveless kimono. People who waste time naming never have time for living.
They passed a few moments in companionable silence. She put the robe on and sat before him.
How is Michael Carnassus? He said at last.
Michael is well. With each rejuvenation, we repair a little more shatter damage. He leaves his extra terrarium for longer and longer times these days. He feels safe in my corridors. He can speak now.
I'm glad for that.
He loves me, I think.
Well, that's not to be despised.
Sometimes, when I think of how much profit I made from him, I have a strange, warm feeling. I never had a better bargain. He was so wonderfully malleable. Even though he's useless now, I still feel real satisfaction when I look at him. I've decided that I'll never throw him away.
Very good.
For a mechanist, he was bright in his day. An ambassador to aliens, he had to be one of the best. He has many children here, congenetics. They are all very satisfactory.
I noticed that when I met Colonel Martin Dimbowska, a very capable officer.
You think so, truly?
Lindsay looked judicious. Well, young, of course, but that can't be helped.
No. And this one, this chatterbox,
the body pointed a finger at its own chest,
is even younger, only 19. But my wall children must grow up quickly. I mean to make Dimbowska my genetic nest. All others must go. And that includes your shaper friend from Skimmer's Union.
I'll take her off your hands at your convenience.
It's a trap, Abelard. Constantine's children have no reason to love you. Don't trust her. Like Carnassus, she has been with aliens. They left their mark on her.
I must confess, I'm curious. He smiled. I suppose it's the drugs.
Drugs? It can't be vasopressin, your old favorite, or you'd have a better memory. Green Rapture, Kitsune. I have certain long-term plans. Green Rapture keeps my interest up.
You're terraforming.
Yes. It's a problem of time and scale, you see. Long-term fanaticism is hard work. Without Green Rapture, the mind gnaws away at the fantastic until it becomes the commonplace.
I see, she said. You're fantastic and my ecstatic. Childbirth is a wonderful thing.
To bring new life into the world, it is the mystery. Truly a pregogenic event.
You must be tired, darling. I've reduced you to cicada platitudes.
I'm sorry, he smiled. It comes with the territory.
You and Wellspring have a clever front. You're both great talkers. I'm sure you can lecture for hours or days, but centuries?
Lindsay laughed. It seems like a joke sometimes, doesn't it? Two sun dogs embracing the ultimate. Wellspring believes, I think. As for me, I do my best.
Maybe he thinks you believe.
Maybe he does. Maybe I do. Lindsay tugged a long lock of hair through his iron fingers. As dreams go, post-humanism has merits. The existence of the four levels of complexity has been proven mathematically. I've seen the equations.
Spare me, darling. Surely we're not so old that we have to discuss equations.
The words bypassed him. Under the influence of Green Rapture, his brain succumbed momentarily to the lure of mathematics, that purest of intellectual pleasures. In his normal state of mind, despite years of study, he found the formulas painful, a brain-numbing mass of symbols. In Rapture, he could grasp them, though afterward he remembered only the white joy of comprehension. The feeling was close to faith. A long moment passed. He snapped out of it.
I'm sorry, Kitsune, you were saying. Do you remember, Abelard? Once I told you that ecstasy was better than being God.
I remember.
I was wrong, darling. Being God is better.
Vera Constantine's quarters were a measure of Kitsune's distrust. The young Shaper clanswoman had been under house arrest for weeks. Her lodging was a three-room cell of stone and iron, outside Kitsune's world-consuming embrace. She sat at an inset market monitor, studying the flow of transaction in a three-dimensional grid. She had never dealt in the market before, but Abelard Gomez, a kindly young cicada, had given her a financial stake to pass the time. Knowing no better, she applied to the flow of the market the principles of atmospheric dynamics she'd learned on Fomalhaut 4. Oddly, it seemed to be working. She was clearly gaining. The door unsealed and shunted open. An old man stepped in, tall and thin, in muted cicada garb. A long coat, dark-slash-cuffed trousers, jeweled rings worn over white gloves. His lined face was bearded, and a silvered coronet of patterned leaves accented his white-streaked shoulder-length hair. Vera rose from her stirrup chair and bowed, imitating the cicada flourish.
Chancellor, welcome.
Lindsay's eyes searched the cell, his sinewy brows knitting in puzzlement. He seemed wary, not of her, but of something in the room. Then she felt it herself. She knew that the presence had returned. Despite herself, knowing it was useless, she looked for it quickly. Something flickered in the corner of her eye as it escaped her vision. Lindsay smiled at her, then he continued to scan the room. She didn't want to tell him about the presence. After a while, he would give up looking for it, just as all the others did. Thank you, he said belatedly. I trust you're well, Captain Doctor.
Your friends Dr. Gomez and Undersecretary Nakamura have been most attentive. Thank you for the tapes and gifts.
It was nothing, Lindsay said. She feared suddenly that she was disappointing him. He had not seen her in the 15 years since the duel. She had been very young then, only 20. She still had the Kelland cheekbones and pointed chin, but time had changed her, and her genotype was not pure. She was not Vera Kelland's clone. Her sleeveless kimono mercilessly showed the changes brought by her years as an alien emissary.
Two circulatory ducts dented the flesh of her neck, and her skin still had a peculiar waxiness. Inside the embassy at Fomalhaut, she had lived in water for years. Lindsay's gray eyes would not stop wandering. She was convinced that he could feel the presence, sense its pervasive eeriness. Sooner or later he would attribute that feeling to her, and then her chance to win his favor would be gone. He spoke abstractedly.
"I'm sorry that matters can't be resolved more quickly. In matters of defection, it's best not to be rash."
She thought she heard a veiled reference to the fate of Nora Mavridis. That chilled her.
"I see your point, Chancellor."
Vera had no official backing by the Constantine clan, for they could not risk denunciation within the Ring Council. Life was hard in Skimmer's Union these days. With the loss of the capital ship had come a vicious struggle for the remaining scraps of power and a hunt for scapegoats. Constantine clan members were prominent victims. Once she had been the favorite of their clan founder, showered with gifts and Constantine's strained affection. But her clan had made too many bad gambles. Philip Constantine had risked their future on the chance to kill Lindsay and had failed. The clan had invested heavily in Vera's ambassadorship, but she had returned without the riches they'd expected. And she had changed in a way that alarmed them. Now she was expendable. As the clan's power dwindled, they had lived in terror of Lindsay. He had survived the duel and returned more powerful than ever. He seemed unstoppable, bigger than life. But the attack they'd expected had never come, and it occurred to them that he had weaknesses. Through her, they hoped to prey on his emotions, on the love or guilt he felt for Vera Kelland. It was the latest and most desperate of gambles. With luck, they might win sanctuary, or vengeance, or both.
"Why come to me?" he said. "There are other places. Life as a mechanist is not so bad as the Ring Council paints it."
"The mechs would turn us against our own people. They would break up our clan. No, Tsarina Cluster is best. There's sanctuary in the shadow of your queen, but not if you work against us."
"I see," Lindsay said. He smiled. "My friends don't trust you. We have very little to gain, you see. CK already swarms with defectors. Your clan does not share our post-human ideology. Worse yet, there are many in CK who hate the name Constantine. Former detentistes, cataclysts, and so on. You understand the difficulties."
"Those days are behind us, Chancellor. We mean no harm to anyone."
Lindsay closed his eyes.
"We could babble reassurances until the sun expands," he said. He seemed to be quoting someone. "And never convince each other. Either we trust each other or we don't."
His bluntness filled her with misgivings. She was at a loss. The silence stretched uncomfortably.
"I have a present for you," she said. "An ancient heirloom."
She crossed the narrow cell to lift a rectangular wire cage, shrouded in peach-colored velvet. She lifted the cage cover and showed him the clan treasure, an albino laboratory rat. It ran back and forth through its cage, mincing along with bizarre, repetitive precision.
"It is one of the first creatures ever to attain physical immortality. An ancient lab specimen. It is over 300 years old."
Lindsay said, "You're very generous." He lifted the cage and examined it. Within it, the rat, its capacity to learn completely exhausted by age, had been reduced to absolute rote behavior. The twitchings of its muzzle, even the movement of its eyes, were utterly stereotyped. The old man watched it searchingly. She knew he would get no response. There was nothing in the rat's jellied pink eyes, not even the dimmest flicker of animal awareness.
"Has it ever been out of the cage?" he said.
"Not in centuries, Chancellor. It's too valuable."
Lindsay opened the cage. Its routines shattered. The rat cowered beside the steel tube of its water drip, its sinewy furred limbs trembling. Lindsay wiggled his gloved fingers beside the entrance.
"Don't be afraid," he told the rat seriously. "There's a whole world out here."
Some ancient corroded reflex kicked over in the rat's head. With a squeal, it launched itself across the cage at Lindsay's hand, clawing and biting in convulsive fury. Vera gasped and leaped forward, shocked at his action, appalled by the rat's response. Lindsay gestured her back and lifted his hand, watching in pity as the rat attacked him. Beneath his torn right glove, hard prosthetic fingers gleamed with black and copper gridwork. He grasped the squirming animal with gentle firmness, watching to see that it did not crack its teeth.
"Prison has set its mind," he said. "It will take a long time to melt the bars behind its eyes."
He smiled. "Luckily, time is in great supply." The rat stopped struggling. It panted in the throes of some rodent epiphany. Lindsay set it gently on the tabletop beside the market monitor. It struggled to its pink feet and began to pace in agitation, turning in its tracks at the former limits of its cage.
"It can't change," Vera told him. "Its capacities are exhausted."
"Nonsense," Lindsay said. "He merely needs to make a pregogenic leap to a new level of behavior."
The calm assertion of his ideology frightened her. Something must have shown in her face. He tugged the torn glove from his hand.
"Hope is our duty," he said. "You must always have hope."
"For years, we hoped we could heal Philip Constantine," Vera said. "Now we know better. We are ready to trade him to you for our own safe conduct."
Lindsay looked at her seriously.
"This is cruelty," he said.
"He was your enemy," she said. "We wanted to make amends."
"For me, you are that chance."
It was working. He still remembered Vera Kelland.
"Don't deceive yourself," he said. "I don't offer true recompense. Tsarina Cluster must fall someday. Nations don't last in this era. Only people last, only plans and hopes. I can only offer you what I have. I don't have safety. I have freedom."
"Post-humanism," she said. "It's your state ideology. Of course we'll adapt."
"I thought you had your own convictions, Vera. You're a galacticist."
She ran her fingers lightly, absently, over one of the gill seams in her neck.
"I learned my politics in the observation sphere. In Fomalhaut, the embassy."
She hesitated.
"Life there changed me more than you could know. There are things I can't explain."
"There's something in this room," she said.
She was stunned.
"Yes," she blurted. "You felt it? Not many do."
"What is it? Something from the Fomalhaut aliens? The gas bags?"
"They know nothing about it."
"But you do," he said. "Tell me."
She was in too far to back out. She spoke reluctantly.
"I first noticed it in the embassy. The embassy floats in the atmosphere of Fomalhaut 4, a gas giant planet like Jupiter. We had to live in water there to survive the gravity. We were thrown together. Mechanists and shapers. We shared the embassy. There was no choice. Everything was changed. We changed. The investors came to take a mechanist contingent back to the Schismatrix. I think the Presence was aboard the investor ship. Since then, the Presence has been with me."
"Is it real?" said Lindsay.
"I think so. Sometimes I almost see it. A kind of flickering, a mirror-colored thing."
"What did the investors say?"
"They denied everything. They said I was deluded."
She hesitated.
"And they weren't the last to say so."
She regretted confessing it at once. But the burden had eased. She looked at him, daring to hope.
"An alien, then," Lindsay said. "Not one of the 19 known species."
"You believe me," she said. "You think that it's really here."
"We must believe each other," Lindsay said. "Life is better that way."
He looked about the narrow room carefully, as if testing his eyes.
"I'd like to lure it into the open."
"It won't come out," the girl said. "Believe me, I've begged it many times."
"We mustn't try it here," Lindsay said. "Any manifestation would alarm Kitsune. She feels secure in this world. We must consider her feelings."
His sincerity startled her. It hadn't occurred to her that her captor might have feelings, or that anyone might relate in a personal way to that titanic mass of flesh. He picked up the rat, which began squealing loudly with desperate energy. He examined it with such guileless interest that, before she could help herself, she felt a stab of pity for him, an urge to protect him. The feeling surprised and warmed her. He said, "We'll be leaving soon. You'll be coming with us." He put the rat in the pocket of his long coat. It rested there quietly. The history of the Schismatrix was one long, racking chronicle of change. The population had reached 9 billion. Within the Ring Council, power had slipped from the narcotized hands of the Zen Serotonists. After 40 years of their reign, new Shaper ideologues embraced the aggressive schemes of visionary galacticism. The new creed had spread slowly. It was born in the interstellar embassies, where ambassadors broke human limits in their struggle to grasp alien ways of life. Now the galacticist prophet stood ready to abandon humanity entirely, to achieve a galactic consciousness where mere loyalty to species was obsolete. Once again, détente had shattered. The mechanists and shapers fought in bitter rivalry for the favor of aliens. Of the 19 alien races, only 5 had shown even the vaguest interest in a closer relationship with humankind. The Chondrul cloud processors were willing to move in, but only if Venus could be atomized for easier digestion. The nerve coral aquatics expressed mild interest in invading the Earth, but this would mean breaking the sacred tradition of interdict. The cultural ghosts were willing to join with anyone who would endure them, but their hideous effects on the schismatric diplomatic corps had made them objects of genuine horror. The gas bags of Fomalhaut offered most. It had taken many decades to master their language, which was best expressed as complex, unstable states of atmospheric dynamics. Once true contact had been established, progress was rapid. Fomalhaut was an enormous star with a huge asteroid belt rich in heavy metals. The asteroid belt was useless to the gas bags, who disliked space travel. They were, however, interested in Jupiter, and planned to seed it with aerial krill. The investors were willing to handle transportation, though even their huge ships could carry only a handful of surgically deflated gas bags per trip. Controversy had raged for decades. The mechanists had their own galacticist faction, who struggled to grasp the mind-shattering physics of the sinister hijack boosters. The boosters, like the investors, possessed a technique of faster-than-light travel. The investors were willing to sell their secret, but only at a crippling price. The hijack boosters mocked mankind, but were occasionally indiscreet. An advance into the galactic arm seemed inevitable. One of two strategies would succeed: that of the Shapers, with their diplomatic negotiation, or of the Mechanists, who directly attacked the problem of Starflight. Only a major faction could succeed. The minor breakaway groups lacked the wealth, the skilled population, the diplomatic pull. A new, uneasy polarity took shape. In the meantime, gas bag larvae and their egg-shaped spacecraft painstakingly inspected circumsolar space. Small groups of Shapers and Mechanist renegades mapped the riches of Fomalhaut. One solar system would never again be enough. The breakdown of détente aroused old hatreds. Brushfire warfare flourished, unrestrained by the faltering investors. Bizarre new factions sprang up, led by returned diplomats. Their recruits loomed at the edges of society. The carnivores, the viral army, the coronaspherics. History's kaleidoscope worked its permutations, its pace ever faster, approaching some unknown crescendo. Patterns changed and warped and flew apart, each chip of light a human life. Tsarina Cluster People's Corporate Republic, 13-1-54. After 70 years of wealth and stability, disaster was loose in Tsarina Cluster. The elite of the Lifesiders clique met in secret council to wrestle with crisis. Aquamarine Discreet was a Lifesider citadel, and its security was absolute. Mosaic blow-ups of the Jovian moon Europa covered the discrete walls. Bright grooved terrain in ice white and dusky orange, interior seas in blue and indigo. Over the burnished conference table hung a European orrery, where jeweled spacecraft representing Lifesider satellites ticked quietly in orbits of silver wire. Chancellor Abelard Gomez, a vigorous 85-year-old, had taken over management of the clique's affairs. His chief compatriots were Professor Glenn Szilard, Queen's advisor Fidel Nakamura, and Gomez's current wife, project manager Jane Murray. At the far end of the table sat Chancellor Emeritus Abelard Lindsay. The old visionary's lined face showed the quizzical smile associated with a heavy dosage of green rapture. Gomez rapped the table, bringing the meeting to order. They fell silent, except for the loud chattering of the ancient rat on Lindsay's shoulder.
"Sorry," Lindsay murmured. He put the rat in his pocket.
Gomez took control.
"Fidel, your report."
"It's true, Chancellor. The Queen has vanished."
The others groaned. Gomez spoke sharply.
"Defected or kidnapped?"
Nakamura wiped his brow.
"Wellspring took her. Only he can answer that. My fellow advisors are in uproar. The coordinator is calling out the dogs. He's even brought the tigers out of mothballs. They want Wellspring for high treason. They won't rest until they have him."
"Or until CK collapses around them," Gomez said. Gloom settled over the chamber.
"Tigers," Gomez said. "Tigers are huge machines. They could shred through the walls of this discrete like paper. We mustn't meet again until we have armed ourselves and established secure perimeters."
Szilard spoke up.
"Our dogs have this suburb's exits monitored. I stand ready to carry out loyalty tests. We can purge the suburb of unfriendly ideologues and make this our bastion as the cluster dissolves."
"That's harsh," Jane Murray said.
"It's us or them," Szilard said. "Once the news spreads, the other factions will be holding kangaroo courts, seizing strongholds, stripping dissidents of property. Anarchy is coming. We must defend ourselves."
"What about our allies?" Gomez said. Nakamura spoke.
"According to our polycarbon clique contact, the announcement of Wellspring's coup d'etat will coincide with the first asteroid impact on Mars, in the morning of 4-14-54. CK will disintegrate within weeks. Most Serena Cluster refugees will flee to Martian orbit. Wellspring holds the Queen there. He will rule. The new terraforming cluster will have a much stronger post-human ideology."
"The mechs and shapers will tear CK apart," Jane Murray said. "And our philosophy profits by the destruction. This is high treason, friends. I feel sick."
"People outlive nations," Lindsay said gently. He was breathing with inhuman regularity. A mechanist bio-cuirass managed his internal organs.
"CK is doomed. No number of dogs or purges can hold it without the Queen. We're finished here."
"The Chancellor Emeritus is right," Gomez told them. "Where will we go? We must decide. Do we join the polycarbon clique around Mars to live in the Queen's shadow? Or do we make our move to circum-European orbit and put our own plans into effect?"
"I say Mars," Nakamura said. "In today's climate, post-humanism needs all the help it can get. The cause demands solidarity."
"Solidarity? Fluidarity, rather," Lindsay said.
He sat upright with an effort.
"What's one queen, more or less? There are always more aliens. Post-humanism must find its own orbit someday. Why not now?"
While the others argued, Gomez looked moodily, through half-shut eyes, at his old mentor. The remnants of old pain gnawed at him. He could not forget his long marriage to Lindsay's favorite, Vera Constantine. There had been too many shadows between himself and Vera. Once they had put the shadows aside. That was when she'd confessed to Gomez that she had meant to kill Lindsay. Lindsay had made no move to defend himself, and there had been many opportunities. But the time had never quite been right, and years passed.
and convictions faltered and became buried in routine and practicalities. The day came when she knew she could not go through with it. She had confessed it to Gomez because she trusted him, and they had loved each other. Gomez led her away from vengeance. She embraced posthumanism. Even her clan had been won over. The Constantine clan were now Lifesiders pioneers, working around Europa. But Gomez himself had not escaped the years. Time had a way of making passion into work. He had what he wanted. He had his dream. He had to live it and breathe it and do its budget. And he had lost Vera, for there had been one shadow left. Vera had never been entirely sane. For years, she had quietly insisted that an alien presence followed and watched her. It seemed to come and go with her mood swings. For days, she would be cheerful, convinced that it was off somewhere. Then he would find her moody and withdrawn, convinced that it was back. Lindsay condoned her illness and claimed to believe her. Gomez, too, believed in the presence. He believed it was the reflection of his wife's estrangement from reality. It was not for nothing that she had called it a mirror-colored thing, something that could not be pinned down, an incarnation of inverifiable fluidity. When Gomez got to the point where he himself could feel it, even sense it flickering at the corners of his vision, he knew things had gone too far. Their divorce had been amiable, full of cool politeness. He wondered sometimes if Lindsay had planned it all. Lindsay knew the trap that was human joy, and the strength that came from clawing free of it. Scalded by pain, Gomez had won that strength. Szilard was reeling off facts and figures about the state of Circum Europa. The future Lifesider's habitat was being blown into shape around the Jovian moon, an orbiting froth of hard-set angles, walls, bubbled topologies. The flourishing Constantine clan was snaking plumbing through the walls already and booting up the life support system. But an attempt by the Lifesiders to move there en masse in their thousands would stretch resources to the limit. Their relations with the gasbag colony on Jupiter were good. They had the expertise of Vera and her cadre of trainees. But the Jovian aliens could not protect them from other human factions. They had no such ambition, and no prestige to match that of the Cicada Queen. Jane Murray presented things from a project perspective. The surface of Europa was the bleakest of prospects, a vacuum-seared wasteland of smooth water ice so cold that blood and bone would crack like glass, bathed in deadly Jovian radiation. But there were fissures in that ice, dark streaks thousands of kilometers long, tidal cracks. For beneath the moon's crust was molten ice, a planet-girdling lava ocean of liquid water. The constant tidal energy of Jupiter, Ganymede, and Io warmed Europa's ocean to blood heat. Beneath the lace-like web of fractures, a sterile ocean washed a bed of geothermal rock. For years, the Lifesiders had planned a series of massive disasters for the inorganic. It would start with algae. They had already bred forms that would survive in the peculiar mix of salts and sulfurs native to European seas. The algae could cluster around fresh cracks where light seeped through, feasting on the strands of heavy hydrocarbons bobbing aimlessly within the sterile sea. Fish would be next, small ones at first, bred from the half-dozen species of commercial fish mankind had brought into space. Ocean arthropods, such as crabs and shrimp, known only from ancient textbooks, could be mimicked through skilled manipulation of the genes of insects. Fault lines could be shattered from orbit by dropping projectiles, leaving light-flooded patches of pack ice. They could experiment on a dozen cracks at once, adapting rival ecosystems through trial and error. It would take centuries. Once again, Gomez took the burden of the years upon himself. "Biodesign is still in its infancy," he said. "We must face facts. At least with the Queen, the Martian cluster will have wealth and safety for us. There, at least, our enemies will be the years." Lindsay lurched forward abruptly and slammed his iron fist into the table. "We must act now. This is the moment of crux, when a single act can crystallize our future. We have our choice, routines or miracles. Demand the miraculous." Gomez was stunned.
"It's Europa, then, Chancellor," he said. "Wellspring's plans seem safer."
"Safer?" Lindsay laughed. "Serena Cluster seemed safe. But the cause moved on, and the Queen moved with it when Wellspring took her. The abstract dream will flourish, but the tangible city will fall. Those who can't dream will die with it. The discreets will be thick with the blood of suicides. Wellspring himself may be killed. Mech agents will annex whole suburbs. Shapers will absorb whole banks and industries. The routines that seemed so solid here will melt like tears. If we embrace them, we melt with them."
"Then what must we do?"
"Wellspring is not the only one whose crimes are secret and ambitious, and he's not the last to vanish."
"You're leaving us, Chancellor?"
"You must handle distress and disaster yourselves. I'm past any use in that capacity."
The others looked stricken. Gomez rallied himself.
"The Chancellor Emeritus is right," he said. "I was about to suggest something similar. Our enemies will focus attacks on the clique's arbiter. It might be best if he were hidden."
The others protested automatically. Lindsay overruled them.
"There can't always be queens and wellsprings. You must trust in your own strength. I trust in it."
"Where will you go, Chancellor?"
"Where I'm least expected," he smiled. "This isn't my first crisis. I've seen many. And when they hit, I always ran. I've preached to you for years, asked you to dedicate your lives, and always I knew that this moment would come. I never knew what I would do when the dream faced its crisis. Would I sundog it as I always have, or would I commit myself? The moment's here. I must defy my past, just as you must. I know how to get you your miracle. And I swear to you I will."
A sudden dread struck Gomez. He had not seen such resolution in Lindsay for years. It occurred to him suddenly that Lindsay meant to die. He did not know Lindsay's plans, but he realized now that they would be the crux of the old man's life. It would be like him to exit at the climax, to fade into the shadows while some unknown glory still shone.
"Chancellor," he said, "when may we expect your return?"
"Before I die, we'll be Europa's angels, and I'll see you in paradise."
Lindsay cycled open the sealed door of the discreet. Outside, the free-fall corridors were a burst of sudden crowd noise. The door thunked shut. He was gone. Thick silence fell. The old man's absence left a hollowness behind. The others sat silent, savoring the sense of loss. They looked at one another. Then, as one, they looked to Gomez. The moment passed. The uneasiness dissolved. Gomez smiled.
"Well," he said, "it's miracles, then."
Lindsay's rat leaped spryly onto the table.
"He's left it behind," Jane Murray said.
She stroked its fur, and it chittered loudly.
"The rat will come to order," Gomez said. He rapped the table, and they set to work.